Good morning, everybody. We have a small but stalwart quorum. Now we have a robust quorum.
Who are you calling robust?
Yeah, exactly. Today is Wednesday, November 28th, 2012. It's 9:30 a.m. I'm gonna gavel council in here for our morning session. But first, I'd like to recognize Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a proclamation to read. Whereas after representing the United States in the 2012 Olympics in London, the United States women's national team received a hero's welcome for its gold medal winning performance on a global stage, and whereas the U.S. women are currently ranked number one in the world by FIFA, and whereas Portland is honored to welcome back the U.S. women's national team to the Rose City, and whereas last night the team held an open practice at Geldwin, I should note that the city of Portland was represented by the Park Rose High School women's soccer team that greeted the national team. And whereas this evening, the team will play an exhibition match against Ireland's women's national team. And whereas Portland's passion for soccer at the recreation, youth, adult, club, high school, college, and professional levels has earned us a national reputation as Soccer City USA. And whereas Portland is proud of its local connection to the U.S. women's team, which includes former University of Portland pilot Megan Rapinoe, who, by the way, is on the short list for FIFA World Player of the Year. And whereas members of the United States women's teams are an inspiration to young athletes across America, including the more than 10,000 youth soccer players in Portland, serving as role models on and off the pitch. Now, therefore, I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, the City of Roses, Soccer City USA, do hereby proclaim Wednesday, November 28th, 2012, to be a day of recognition for the U.S. women's national team in Portland, recognizing the many ways these world-class athletes contribute to our community, congratulating the team on its remarkable success, and encouraging Portlanders to make healthy outdoor activity part of their regular routine. And Mayor, Martha Pellegrino and I were at the practice last night, and congratulations to the Park Rose women's soccer team that actually greeted on behalf of the city the team. Thanks to Nike, the Timbers, the U.S. national team, and the Oregon Sports Authority. And there's a picture in today's sports section which shows a young woman from Park Rose reacting to receiving an autograph from Megan Rapinoe. And what was really beautiful about that is Megan Rapinoe played at the University of Portland, was an All-American, is now considered the best player in the world, and she recently bought an apartment in downtown Portland. She now calls Portland home, and she's on the short list to be on the professional team that Portland will organize in the new Women's Professional Soccer League. So it brought together a lot of nice things, and once again, we welcome back the gold medal national team to Portland. Thank you.
Very exciting. Thank you. Carla, can you good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
Good. Can you please call the roll?
Leonard? Fritz.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Adams.
Here. Good morning, everybody. The rules of the House are you have to sign in if you want to testify. When your name is called for an item, you come up and sit in one of these chairs. There's a clock in front of that piece of wood that will count down 3 minutes. You need to give us your first and last name, not your address, not your email, phone number, none of that. You need to, unless it's one of the five folks for communications, your testimony needs to adhere to the issue that's being discussed for a particular council item. If you are a lobbyist that is authorized to lobby on behalf of an organization, you need to declare that. Otherwise, we're assuming that you're just here representing your own point of view. So, Carla, would you please read the item, communications number 1309.
Request of Scott Ford to address council regarding Taxi Limousine Commission complaint, Portland Airport, and taxi cab fare rates.
Mr. Ford. Hi, welcome.
Thank you for this opportunity, Commissioners and Mayor. Beginning March 1st, 2012, I've first initiated a fare that was pretty astronomical, riding from Portland International Airport to my residence downtown. It was $63. Continuing trips on September 14th, October 4th, and November 7th. The fares were also $47, $56, and $62. It was my understanding when I addressed this to the Portland Taxi and Limousine Commission, the fare charges should have been 25 to 35 within a zone. Can someone outline to me why I would be paying more at 2 a.m., 3 o'clock hours when there should be some sort of implementation that it should be a flat rate within the downtown zone? Because it was my understanding that it's 25 to 35. And obviously, we have a beautiful city here. And if we have tourists that are coming and taking taxi cab rides, we're sort of being ripped off at this point as far as paying those fares that are pretty high.
We'll have to get back to you. Do you remember who you talked to at the...
I left packets with their office, and I also left packets with you guys.
Great. So. All right, we'll follow up. Thank you very much for bringing it to our attention, and we'll get back to you with an answer. Can you please read the title for communications item number 1310?
Request of Mary King to address council regarding the economics of paid sick leave. She is rescheduling to the 5th.
Okay. Can you please read the title, communications item number 1311?
Request of Craig Rogers to address council regarding East Portland Community Center. He let us know he's not able to make it.
Okay. Can you please read the title for communications item number 1312?
Request of Jerry Giglieri to address council regarding economic development plan.
Hi, welcome.
Well, I have some very good news for the city. It's always nice to give a gift and not charge dime. But I'm bringing up some old business but new information. The USS Ranger, we have a new placement for the ship down on the Willamette River on the east side. And she's what you would say economic impact for the city. All these carriers that are around the country bring a tremendous amount of revenue to their cities, and they are also regional. And we would like to do this for Portland. Great opportunity to have jobs, and because of the amount of revenue that the ship would generate, Portland can only win on this one because they do bring a lot of revenue. And so that's kind of what we're real excited about, education, also emergency preparedness. This ship has a lot to offer. This is not a warship. This is a floating airport. But it would now be a museum, which we think would be wonderful for everyone to enjoy. And I can imagine a lot of the universities and school would probably have satellite classrooms aboard. The other good news is, along with that, there's a very large building. I think you all have a picture. And that building is 77,000 square feet building, which was built in 1892. So that's kind of historic. And what we would like to do with that building is make it the largest Native American museum in the entire West Coast, and incorporating also the state of Washington. We have so many great tribes, and what a culture, what a treasure that would be. This would give Portland, you have no tourist attraction here, so wouldn't it be nice to have not only a floating museum with a lot of education going on, plus for emergency preparedness, you've got 64 ICU beds on that ship alone. So if something were to happen, think where people can go. And this is really wonderful. But I think the financial aspect for the business community in Portland would be tremendous, and including a lot of education, which there would be classrooms there. So that's wonderful. So we've just, and we're not asking the city for a dime. We want to bring something to you that's wonderful that everybody can share. And having the largest Native American museum on the West Coast, there's your tourist attraction, and that's all year round. So we're pretty excited about it, and we wanted to share that with you because it would be on the east end of the Willamette River. And the good news is you've got light rail. which is right there too, that would everyone would benefit from this in the business community.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Are there any questions? All right.
Thank you
for this opportunity.
Carla, can you please read the title for communications item number 1313?
Request of Anna Steifvater to address council regarding earned sick days. She will be rescheduling.
Okay. All right, that gets us to the consent agenda. I've had a request to pull 1318. Any other requests to pull? Can you read the title for 1318?
Authorize multiple applications to the Oregon Department of Transportation for grants in the amount of up to $39.125 million for transportation enhancement projects.
Any other items to pull? If not, Carla, can you please call the roll on the consent agenda?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I just wanted to also note that we, in our consent agenda, we are appointing Tad Savinar to the Design Commission. Tad is here, but didn't want to say anything. But I just want to acknowledge what an outstanding addition he will be to our Design Commission. I think perhaps no one other than Tad has a good feel for the city and how it should look and how it looks and how we can always improve it. So we appreciate him devoting the many hours it will take to be on the Design Commission. A good addition. Aye.
Adams.
Congratulations. Aye. So approved. All right. Can you please read the item and call the vote for 1348?
Amend the business license.
Oh, I'm sorry. No. Just read the title. I'll take it from there.
1348. Amend the business license law to increase the owner's compensation deduction maximum for the 2013 tax year.
All right, so earlier, I don't know who's staff here for this. So earlier this, come on up if folks have any technical questions. So earlier this year, I authorized an amnesty for businesses that had found themselves not having paid the appropriate amount of the city's business license fee. At the time, I said that one-time revenues would be, as determined by the city economists, one-time revenues would be used for the existing fiscal year, but that any revenues that were booked as being received on an ongoing basis by the city's economists, that I propose that we apply that to further increasing the owner's compensation deduction. That is a goal of the City of Portland's to increase that and apply that to such an effort. So the owner's compensation deduction for 2012 is $88,500. And so 2013 with this amount would raise it $2,000 to $90,500. Modest amount, but shows our continuing good faith and commitment to this policy of the city. We would be happy to answer any questions you have.
So just to be clear, this is an ongoing change. So this is a not a 1 year.
Correct.
And I think we've had a goal of ultimately getting it up to $125,000.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Does anyone wish to testify in 1348? Does anyone in the room wish to testify in 1348? All right. Moves to a second reading. Further consideration by the City Council next week. Can you please read the title for 1349?
Achieve 100% renewable electricity for city operations by directing the Bureau of Internal Business Services and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to facilitate a purchase of renewable energy certificates each year on behalf of all city bureaus.
And go ahead and read the 1350 and 1351.
1350, authorized revenue bonds for the lighting efficiency program. 1351, invest savings from LED streetlight conversion in system replacement and renewable energy.
So 3 years ago, the City Council adopted a climate action plan to reduce carbon emissions by 40% by 2030 and 80% by 2050. One of the actions outlined in the plan is to purchase or generate 100% of all the electricity required for city operations from renewable sources by 2012. It's interesting to note one of the largest misconceptions about where our electricity comes from is that we get our electricity from Bonneville or from dams on the Columbia River. We are very proud to be the regional headquarters for the Bonneville Power Administration, but we get virtually no power, electricity power, from the Bonneville system. Instead, we get 40% of our electricity, the last time I checked, from coal plants, and approximately another 30% from other fossil fuel-based, like natural gas. So although we like to talk a good talk about being sustainable, when you plug in your toaster, your hairdryer, or sit under these lights, for every 10 minutes, 7 of those minutes come from non-renewable sources. What's in front of us is the proposal to modernize our streetlights so that we are energy efficient. We are providing much better light than the orange lights that you see if you land at Portland Airport at night that are outdated. We're also, in doing that, seeking to fulfill our commitment made in the climate action policy to purchase renewables. The overall, including the streetlight cost, is around, what, 280, more or less?
Should be a little less than that, yes.
Less than 280. Because you'll recall, Council will recall, the kilowatt crackdown program that we've started with the building and BOMA, the Building and Managers Association here in Portland, were part of that kilowatt crackdown. And so we're giving bureaus a year to come up with the efficiencies so that the cost to the taxpayers for this is actually below the $180,000 that's estimated right now to be purchasing renewable power. And with the kilowatt crackdown program, we're giving them the technical assistance to do just that. I think the last time the city did a major push on renewables was under Commissioner Saltzman when you first put together the Office of Sustainable Development, and the city did a very aggressive and expansive effort to make its own operations more energy efficient. So this builds on that, and there's a lot of new technology, as evidenced by you're going to hear about the LEDs, and it's time that we do it again. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Mayor. Commissioners, I want to just show a couple slides, I think, to illustrate where we are in terms of our electricity use and what this opportunity to purchase renewable energy certificates to for the equivalent of our current power that comes from non-renewable sources. The chart in front of you.
You want to introduce yourself, Mike?
Sure. Yes. Thank you. I apologize. I'm Michael Armstrong with the City's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. The chart in front of you shows our current production from on-site renewables at city facilities, big ones being out at the wastewater treatment plant where we produce power from biogas. We have a number of solar installations. We have some small wind turbines and some small hydro facilities as well. Those amount to about 9% of our electricity needs. We're also now getting up almost 7% of our power from new renewable sources through the utilities. That's under state law. They're complying with that, part of the overall policy framework. The balance of our power does come from the grid, and as the mayor noted, that is primarily from coal with significant amounts of natural gas as well. There's some hydro, but it is overwhelmingly fossil fuel based. We've included the piece on top for efficiency projects since 1990. Bureaus really have been very diligent in pursuing these opportunities for quite a few years now, and those savings amount to about $5 million a year in lower energy bills for the city than they otherwise would have been. So we have made real progress there. There are plenty of opportunities still to go, as the mayor noted. The proposal in front of you would essentially take that middle section, the electricity purchased from utilities, and apply an overlay of renewable energy certificates, which is essentially the green attributes of power produced from new renewable resources like wind, geothermal, biomass, solar. You'll also see in this chart, we're adding in the conversion to LED streetlights that we'll talk about in a minute. It is a huge project. It would be the single largest energy efficiency project in the city's history, to my knowledge. It will reduce our total energy use by about by a little over 10%, our total electricity use. It's a huge project. You'll hear more about it in a minute. That's the kind of project that helps reduce our overall demand, and we have less energy that we need to green up through renewables. So it's a really important piece of this. I want to underscore the mayor's point about the sources of our power. For the city of Portland as a whole, the numbers are indeed a little over 40%, as the mayor noted. Just because of the location of where city facilities are, they tend to be in Portland General Electric service territory, slightly less coal. We come in at about 34% with the most recent numbers. The citywide number is over 40%, but it's still less than a third is hydro, 7-8% from new renewables.
Oh, it's gotten better. Good.
It has gotten, it's about the same, honestly. It's a question of where city facilities are located. So your numbers are exactly right. On average, the city pays 8.6 cents per kilowatt hour across all of our facilities, operations, streetlights, wastewater treatment plant facilities, everything, mostly Portland General Electric, some Pacific Power. I want to contrast the power mix you get with that price with what you're contemplating today. So currently we're paying 8.6 cents per kilowatt hour. On the left, we get this mix of largely coal and natural gas, some hydro. On the right is the proposal that's in front of you. An estimated cost of 8.8 cents per kilowatt hour. You know, the actual numbers will depend. You know, if this goes forward, we would do a procurement process, and so we would need to see what the bids are. But the estimated cost would be an additional 0.2 cents per kilowatt hour. That greens up the entire rest of the pie for city operations. So that's the proposal. It's intended to give bureaus some flexibility about if they've budgeted the funds this year, as at least one bureau has, they could proceed with the purchase now. Others would be able to budget for it as part of the budgeting process for 13-14. We're trying to accommodate different bureaus which are in different places at this time.
Mayor, could I follow up with that?
So,
Michael, what's the total aggregate cost to the city then of this shift?
The incremental cost we estimate at, I think the resolution says $250,000. It'll depend a little on the actual bids we get back. Could be a little lower than that. I think it could be a little higher. Mayor had the number of 280. That's possible. I think it'll be a little less than that.
But the goal is to give bureaus the time to go in through the kilowatt crackdown, which we had in front of us, and reduce their out-of-pocket cost to zero.
Right. And so the LED streetlight project, as you'll hear, is an example of that, where there are, you know, very big savings to the city from the efficiency projects.
Why does green power cost more than coal power?
Because green power is not subsidized to the degree that the fossil fuel industry is subsidized. But that's my answer.
And, you know, the person I would want to answer that is maybe one of our witnesses here in a few minutes. So if I could let Angus Duncan address that.
Okay.
There are many reasons.
And so I would like to hear more about that. And then my second question is, if everybody in Portland were to purchase green power, would that mean that the companies would stop doing using fossil fuels? I mean, that the electricity doesn't know where it came from.
If everyone switched to green power overnight, it
yes.
would be very messy, just in terms of the contracts and how power flows. Over time, and this is where the grid, the overall electric grid, was not built to handle the kinds of variable power production that you get from renewable resources. And so it badly needs to be modernized as well to be able to handle many different sources of power as opposed to just a couple of big, mostly coal-fired power plants. And so over time, it is entirely possible that we can get there. You know, overnight, it would be a big technological challenge.
And so then my last question, which again might be for somebody else to answer, is what does the extra money go for?
So the funds would go to buy what are called renewable energy certificates, which, and this is where, you know, power gets produced at the wind farm, at the solar facility, wherever the power plant is, and fed into the grid. And then, you know, you can't track an electron. It goes where it goes. But the environmental attributes of that power, in this case, are separated from the electricity part of it. And so the electricity gets sold into the grid as sort of generic power. It's not considered renewable because the renewable piece is attached to the certificate, which gets tracked very carefully and traded separately, so bought and sold. And so we would be buying and selling that. Because of the requirements for utilities to have certain percentages, you know, us essentially buying those certificates for ourselves means they have to get their certificates and their renewable power from someplace else, and so it adds to the demand and helps new facilities be brought online.
So does the extra 0.2 cents go to the wind farmer?
The extra 2 point, it would go to the, and ultimately it goes to the companies that develop and, you know, provide the wind power or the other source of renewable power. Yes.
So, Michael, the question I have is, if we buy 100% green power, whatever percentage that we previously had purchased that was generated by coal or natural gas or other fossil fuel power, does that amount of generation greenhouse gases cease to occur, or does it shift to somebody else on the grid who purchases it? In other words, in a more global view, are we just shuffling cards, chairs on the deck? Or is there actually a reduction in the total amount of greenhouse gases produced that equals the amount of increased green power we purchase?
Right. So this is also a kind of what happens the day we buy the certificates mm-hmm. versus what happens over time, where the day we buy the certificates, the physical earth didn't change. So that power is still being produced at the facilities that were producing it before. But over time, it absolutely will shift demand away from coal and natural gas.
Wow.
And because the people owning and running those power plants won't be able to sell their power competitively because there's less demand for it. And so it's supply and demand, where increasingly we've got more fossil fuel supply than, as demand shifts to lower carbon sources, there's less demand for it. And so, for example, Boardman, we're seeing shut down in 2020 instead of at least 2040, maybe 2050. And so that's exactly
the result of a decrease in demand for coal-powered electricity?
As a result in...
That was more of a mandate by the state.
Well, it was a
negotiated.
It was a negotiation, and it was in part responding to the risk of continuing to run a coal plant with uncertainties, and a lot of those uncertainties have to do with a shift away from fossil fuels. And so whether that ends up looking like a cap and trade system or a carbon tax, you know, all of these things are combining to put pressure on the coal power plants.
So it's fair to say us shifting to 100% green power induces or incents generating facilities such as those that PGE and PP&L control to convert to solar fields or wind power, or it doesn't really do anything right now in terms of the amount of carbon emitted into the atmosphere. It does, however, create more of an incentive for them to shift.
I think that's a fair way to say it.
Yeah. Yep.
And it's, as you know, Commissioner, it's a real live, that shift is a real live and open question here in Oregon, because while Boardman is shutting down, PG is also looking at, do they have other options there besides
yeah.
not only natural gas, which is more efficient,
right.
not renewable, but they're also looking at more cutting edge energy production options. And if they know that.
Like nuclear.
No, not nuclear.
Small nuclear.
Small nuclear.
Portable nuclear.
Basement nuclear power plants. And it's going to be in your basement. Shall we hear a little? I'm not going to continue talking.
Yeah, I have some more questions, but we can finish the full presentation.
Yeah, let's hear about streetlights. This is an example of the savings and how we've waited, even though others have done it much earlier. We've waited and learned by their experience, and we've also waited until the technology we felt was proven enough that you really get not only the electricity savings, but also the less maintenance required savings as well. Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you, Mayor. Peter Kuntz, Division Manager for Signals and Street Lighting with the Portland Bureau of Transportation. Commissioners, thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today. I'm excited to share some of the work that we've been doing in street and outdoor lighting. Over the past several years, we've been working with our partners, our regional partners, Portland General Electric and other cities throughout the metro area on a street lighting tariff. that includes the use of LEDs. The recent passage of this tariff at the Oregon Public Utilities Commission provides us an opportunity for the city to implement efficient streetlights in the coming years. The ordinance in front of you today authorizes the city to issue revenue bonds to finance the purchase of lighting fixtures and their installation that will result in a net savings to the city over the life of the project. The project will convert over 46,000 streetlights in 5 years. The setup of the first phase of the financing will provide the city with the certainty needed to complete the entire project. Jonas will talk a little more about the financing portion of it, but I will say that the savings achieved through implementation of this will allow us to pay back the bond ultimately and reduce the general fund transfer that currently pays the street lighting bill. The question we asked ourselves is, why would we convert to LEDs now? And the mayor mentioned that we're not the first city that's embarked upon this sort of a project. We've been watching very carefully how the city of Seattle has taken the lead in doing a very similar project. They started their efforts in 2009, and initially their cost of the LEDs was more expensive than today's purchase. So we feel confident moving forward that we have a cost-effective solution. The LEDs have come down in price, much like you would find if you went to the store and went to look for Christmas lights that are LEDs today. The price has come down so that we can offer a net savings to the city of doing this project. We have had some experience with LEDs in the past, however. We've done all of the red and green indications of the traffic signals, so the city is familiar with this sort of a project, and we're excited about the opportunity to extend that to street lighting. While we've done the traffic signals, we've done a similar size of the fixtures and traffic signals, the street lighting offers a better savings beyond the traffic signals because of the power consumption. The power consumption, as Michael pointed out, of street lighting is significant for the city. So overall, by converting to LEDs, we'll save up to 50% of the power that we have today, which is a substantial piece of our overall carbon footprint. The other reason to do this is to essentially extend the maintenance of the existing fixtures. Today's high-pressure sodium, the orange light, as the mayor mentioned, has a lifespan of 5 years. Today's LEDs that we would buy today have a lifespan of over 20 years. The manufacturers suggest a 24-year lifespan, which if you think about the maintenance elements of that, not only does it use reduced power consumption, but it also means that we have to go visit those lights and replace them less often than we have had in the past. So that offers savings not only just in the energy side, but also on the maintenance side per fixture. As I mentioned, Seattle has done 48,000 streetlights. They're finishing their project. Our staff are actually up there today looking at what they've been doing, trying to make sure that we understand the logistics of this. That's an important part of this. But there are other examples. Los Angeles is embarking on a 140,000 LED retrofit system. Boston's doing 18,000, and San Francisco's doing nearly 20,000. So we've done our homework with looking at what our partners in Seattle have been doing and plan to employ those same practices on our project. We have some history with street lighting and LEDs. On the Coley Boulevard project, we did some research with the Pacific Northwest Natural Laboratories to look at the quality of light and found that when we went out and surveyed the public, found that the public enjoyed the wider light. And from a public safety standpoint, we know that wider light is more effective. So that project, along with the Elijah Loop LED demo project, are two examples where we've implemented LEDs and we feel confident moving forward that this is the right decision for the city. So overall, an exciting project for us in terms of the cost savings, the quality of the light being better, in terms of improving the livability of the city and improving the public safety. The five-year retrofit program is really a function of the existing relamping schedule. We would follow as the existing high-pressure sodium lights burn out. And even before that, we will relamp those fixtures. And we also have been in discussion with Parks to partner with them to work on a similar project for the next phase of the project, which is the ornamental streetlights, both in Parks and in what you see in downtown Portland. So with that, I'll end by saying that we're excited about this opportunity and looking forward to any questions you may have.
What's the difference in power consumption between an LED streetlight and a current streetlight emitting the same amount of lumens?
It's approximately 55% less. What we're looking at is there are some locations where the street lighting may be insufficient for the, what we're trying to use the street for today. A good example of that is the neighborhood greenways. If you think about using those residential streets differently to encourage people on bikes on those streets, we may want to increase the level of lighting on those facilities. So we're going to, as a part of the project, look at that and be mindful of, do we need to change the lighting? Are there pedestrian crossings that weren't there before? Are there opportunities that we need to have a different lens of which we look at this sort of service to the citizens and change what we've done?
Can I ask a question? When you convert 47,000 existing city lights to LEDs over 3 to 5 years, what do you do with the current lights? And assuming those lights still have shelf life, what happens to them?
Our current plan is to follow the relamping schedule. So today, the hypersodium lights that are there are replaced on a 5-year schedule. So that's why the project is a 5-year plan. We'll have to replace those lights regardless. So as we follow that relamping schedule, we will just follow the ones that are likely to burn out in the next few months and implement an LED. This project does include recycling of those old heads, and we will get paid for the recycling of those heads. We've been happy to see that there's a market for those, and so there's a small incremental savings for the project for recycling those facilities. But they'll be near the end of their useful life, and so we see that as essentially a net zero.
In addition to that, I appreciate that answer. I encourage you to prioritize for safety and for equity when in the replacement schedule, that there would be value, for instance, in prioritizing some of the high crash areas, Foster Road, Division, 82nd, some earlier, even if they're not due for until later in the schedule. I would encourage you to take a look at that, lighting low-income neighborhoods better earlier. And then I have a question. Are you going to talk about the ownership of the poles?
Yes, that's another portion of the project. Thanks for bringing that up. It's a small portion of our overall request, but a significant portion. The portion of the poles in East County primarily, but throughout the city, is that they are streetlight-only poles. So part of this would give us the opportunity to purchase those poles from PGE and PP&L, wherever the poles lie in their service area. And allow us to eliminate the rental costs associated with the poles that are streetlight-only poles. Today, with distribution poles, the poles that cover that carry the power lines, those are poles that are owned by the utility that are in our right-of-way. And so we don't charge them to be in our right-of-way, and they don't charge us for having the streetlight mounted on those poles. There are 4,080 poles that are what we call option A poles, streetlight-only poles, that are owned by the utility, and we rent those poles from them. By purchasing those 4,000 poles to the tune of $1.08 million, we'll eliminate a $320,000 rental cost per year, so a payback of about 3.5 years, which is again, something that we've talked about quite a bit in Signals and Streetlighting, just haven't had the means to do that. So we're excited about reducing our costs even further by reducing that rental cost and taking ownership of those streetlight poles.
And then how much does it cost to replace them? Because presumably when we rent them, the utility's responsible for replacement?
Yes, we have factored in costs for replacement of those poles. A lot of those poles, the average age of those poles is approximately 26 years. There are poles in the Lads Edition neighborhood that are 60 years old that are still functional.
Petrified wood.
So we're excited about that. If we pay them off in 3.5 years, that replacement opportunity is there. We'll have resources to do that. We will not have to pay back, we'll pay back the bond amount, but then ongoing we'll have additional resource to be able to replace those poles if they do indeed need to be replaced.
So the $375,000, is that enough to do replacement as well as maintenance?
It is. Those poles have a very good lifespan, and so that's something that we've been doing a due diligence to confirm that those poles are of sufficient quality to purchase them and that we feel confident of the maintenance ongoing.
But if we're buying 26-year-old poles that we've been paying rent for with presumably they've been amortizing their projected replacement cost, are we losing something there?
No, the ongoing rental cost is presumed as a part of that cost. So there are... it's something that we have factored in. We have talked to the Oregon Public Utilities Commission about. So they've basically set a fair price for those poles. And as we see moving forward, there's an opportunity there that gives us a net benefit for the city.
Thank you. Which of the three items is the purchase of the pole contained in? The three agenda items that I have today?
The second of the three.
And is that, say, non-emergency ordinance? So if you could get me the study for the information of the cost benefit of buying versus rental before next week, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Other questions, Commissioner?
I have some questions, but I see our city debt manager here.
Would you like to say something?
Sure. Let me say a couple things, if you don't mind, on item 1350 and 1351, and may clear up some of the financing and savings issues. Let me say first, this is actually, you know, the finance guy always goes last because usually it's the boring part. This is actually a really exciting opportunity for me because we've got a great program that produces some savings structures. So it's an opportunity to try to minimize the cost of borrowing within a available stream of revenues and maximize the savings that ultimately kind of accrue back to the city. Item 1350 authorizes limited tax revenue bonds to finance up to $18.5 million for projects, as Peter described, including the poles. The bonds will be secured by full faith and credit of the city, expected to be paid back from general fund savings generated through implementation of the program. I'm going to talk a bit about the savings in a second. In order to match the debt service to the anticipated savings, we're actually going to do this in two different phases. The first financing phase should be about $6.5 million. We expect that to be issued via competitive bidding process early next year. Second phase is of about $12 million, prospectively issued in fiscal 14-15, pending expenditure of the $6.5 million and savings generated at the levels we currently expect. Second phase will also be structured such that the debt service payments will be less than and eventually exceed, that savings will be sufficient to cover the debt service, combined debt service, and eventually exceed that. Each phase of the bond is expected to mature over 15 years or less. If we just look at the first $6.5 million, we expect about $300,000 debt service payment in 13-14 and $660,000 annually thereafter through fiscal 24-25. That will be less than the savings that's projected. So let's talk a little about the savings. That's addressed in item 1351. Upon full implementation, the combined maximum annual debt service is projected at roughly $1.7 million a year. Savings is projected at somewhere around $2.8 million a year. Current projections indicate that the total savings after payment of the full debt service, there's still an additional $20 million plus in savings over the 20 to 24-year useful life of the LED program. As I said, the combined debt service is expected to be a net zero, so essentially the debt service will be structured to match the savings for the first 4 years. And then beginning in fiscal 16-17, there will be savings above the expected annual debt service. So item 1351 directs that savings after payment of debt service be used for a couple specific purposes. The first is for purchase of 100% renewable energy for the streetlight program. That cost is estimated at around $84,000 per year. And then secondly, amounts above that will be allocated to be placed into a reserve to cover replacement costs of the LED program. So that what that does, funding the reserves sort of insulates us from having to incur future costs. As the life of those LEDs expire, we won't need to go out and finance them again. It allows us the ability to really maximize the savings for additional uses and not have to sort of reapply those towards recapitalizing at the end of the useful life.
Mayor, can I seek a clarification on that point? In the financial impact statement at page 2, it says a separate ordinance will address the use of the savings beyond that which is necessary to service the debt. But you've just described two categories of savings above debt service that would not come back to us by ordinance.
Correct. So there's two ordinances. 1350 is the financing ordinance itself, and I believe that's the one that you're referring to. That only refers to payment of the debt service. Item 1351, kind of companion ordinance, addresses those two savings categories that I described.
So just to clarify, because I believe the financial impact statement is drafted
I believe it refers to authorizing the revenue bonds. But it's very clear that a separate ordinance would be required for any savings beyond what is necessary. But that's the two again, I just want clarification, because the two categories you've described, reserve fund and renewable energy, those are not technically necessary to service the debt. Those are other potentially council priorities, but I don't still see how that's consistent with what's in the financial impact statement.
So I believe, and I'm looking for it, there should be a financial impact statement applied in 1351 that is independent, shouldn't say independent,
okay.
is related
there
to,
is. Yeah.
But independent from the financial impact statement on the revenue bond ordinance.
Okay, there is a separate one for that. And that, your recollection is that specifies that those additional categories of reserve, those that we can spend savings for those purposes before it comes back to council for authorization to spend anything beyond that?
That's my understanding.
Commissioner Seltzman?
Are revenue bonds always backed by the full faith and credit of the general fund?
When in this case, what we're calling limited tax revenue bonds, limited tax meaning they're supported by a limited pool of tax revenues, general fund is the more broadly used term. Yes, those are typically, when the city issues limited tax revenue bonds, typically supported by the full faith and credit. I say different because different from water revenue bonds, for example, where they're securely, they're both called revenue bonds, but water revenue bonds secured solely by water revenues.
So anything that's sort of related to a general fund activity, is that considered a limited tax revenue bond backed by the full faith and credit of the?
Generally, yes.
And so you're, and I assume this financing mechanism has been used, I'm assuming, by other cities. And I
mean, correct.
The savings are pretty well, the savings, energy savings we'll see that will repay these bonds, or you have a pretty high confidence level around this, I'm assuming, that the savings will materialize.
And one of the reasons we're confident is because there is a tariff with those rates. We know exactly what we're going to pay for the energy side of it. You know, there we've had to estimate what the cost of, you know, the installation and a few other pieces. But I know that Peter has
a tariff for streetlights in general, or for
LEDs specifically.
So it's a lower
exactly.
tariff.
Yep.
Okay.
Right.
So you can kind of book on those savings using that to be most conservative. If you just took the lower tariff savings, that could be the source.
One potential risk is if energy costs plummet. That would then present an opportunity for us to ask PGE to revise the tariff, but they're not under an obligation to do that. They can maintain the existing tariff, which includes not just the energy cost but also the maintenance and other costs that they charge us as a part of that tariff.
So as our debt manager, you have it sounds like you said you're excited about this, so it sounds like to me you have a high confidence that the energy savings are going to be able to service the revenue bonds.
Right, correct. And let me say that I mean, we're Office of Management and Finance is confident that the PBOT project folks have done a significant amount of due diligence, including working with some outside consultants. We've also, as is typical, run a fairly conservative analysis with conservative savings assumptions and conservative cost assumptions. So that does give us confidence. Additionally, because the program, the financing implementation is a couple of phases, it gives us some flexibility to either accelerate or delay implementation of the financing to match actual realized savings.
But can I piggyback off of Dan's question for a second? Because this, in a sense, we're charting new territory here, and there's lots of areas of government where an upstream investment produces savings, which technically we could craft in an argument to cover revenue bonds like this. And the frustration is we don't have those dollars to go upstream, so we spend more money downstream. But in the ordinance, it defines revenue as income or receipts to which a public body is entitled. How does a savings become the same thing as a revenue or income to which we're entitled? It seems like a savings is a wonderful thing to aspire to, but it doesn't seem to have the same predictability, certainly, as something to which you're entitled. And I think we're more familiar with those revenue streams.
Correct. So I think the difference here is the ordinance is the definition of the ordinance is referring to sort of statutorily required definition of revenues. The pledge for these repayment of these bonds is not savings. The pledge is everything the city receives. So let me think of a similar example. Might be we've done financings for transportation that are secured by the full faith and credit, the revenues as they're defined here, but ultimately we pay them from parking revenues or gas tax revenues.
I see.
So it's a similar situation. They're secured by the broad revenues, but going to be paid from.
And does that impact the interest rates that we get in the market? Does it change the investor's view of this if it's not a specific pledge of a revenue and it's just the general?
It does not in this case because we are pledging the full faith and credit. So we get the same cost of borrowing as we would any other time we're pledging the full faith and credit.
Have we done this before, this mechanism of using savings as the driver?
In my experience at the city, we have not necessarily. This is a little bit unique in that usually we're looking for a new stream of revenue or an existing a fee increase or cuts to something else. So there's a little bit more of a of that. This is a different analysis because we are confident that it's releasing.
My understanding, though, that in the private sector, there are financial tools or financial products that provide this kind of financing, like Johnston Controls will finance your clean energy retrofits, Clean Energy Works of Oregon, to a lesser degree, is a little further away from this model. And then other cities have made assumptions about the savings that they're going to get. What I like about this conservative approach is that you're doing it in tranches. So it's not the entire amount. We actually have studied the actual experiences of other large cities, but we get to, in coming up with these conservative assumptions, but now we are going to be doubly conservative by taking out debt portions at a time in phases.
But wouldn't this be not unlike if one were to refinance their house for a lower interest rate and the money you saved, you invested in insulating your attic or putting in windows that were more energy efficient? Is that a fair
analogy? I think that's
a fair
analogy.
Okay.
Yeah. There is history for this. In 1980, we went from mercury vapor streetlights to high-pressure sodium, the ones that we have today, and we used the savings to purchase the streetlights from PGE at that time. The study that was done at that time showed that the cost savings was in 6 years because the mercury vapor requires so much more energy than the high-pressure sodium did of that day. So it's history repeating itself to some degree. That technology has leapfrogged essentially the energy consumption of our today's fixtures. And so that's history does repeat itself, if you will.
The issue you mentioned acquiring poles from PGE, if we so wanted to, is that a willing seller type deal? Or?
It is. It's part of the Oregon Public Utility Commission tariff. We have the opportunity to purchase those poles. We're going to take ownership and retain ownership of the streetlights that are attached to those poles.
So on the turning out of the renewable energy certificates or credits, so those are sold on some sort of an exchange, right? Is it like a stock exchange? More or less, I mean, kind of like that?
Well,
I mean, where do you get a renewable energy certificate?
So we would issue an RFP, and there are various, in some case, you know, the original producer still owns the certificate. They might offer to sell. There are brokers who buy and then turn around and sell.
Okay.
So we would presumably get a variety of bids, and
somebody validates that they do come from renewable energy projects.
Exactly. We would specify, you know, as we have in the past, we bought small quantities of these, and we would specify that they meet certain certification standards, and then they are tracked. They have individual numbers on them, and then this has become quite. It's a very serious accounting business, so there's high confidence that they are legitimate.
Are we able to, this probably runs against some law somewhere, but are we able to stipulate that we want renewable energy credits from Oregon-based renewable projects or Oregon, Washington, or something like that, or is that like a commerce issue?
I believe we can do that. And as we've looked at the options, you get a range of prices depending on where the credits are produced. And so it's something that also I think will inform the ultimate decision is, you know, you can pay more for one from
one. So something you could look at through an RFP basis, say,
absolutely,
give me your price for this, give me your price for that.
Mm-hmm. And then we may employ a criteria in the RFP that says, all other things being equal, we would prefer maybe Oregon, Washington based.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. In the intervening week we have, maybe you could get back to the commissioner and copy us some more details around that.
We can do that.
Great.
And then my final question is, the utilities in Oregon now have a renewable purchase portfolio obligation of, I think, 25% by 2025.
Yeah.
Does this count towards their portfolio? Since we buy our power from PGE and Pacific Power, does this count towards their 25%?
Our purchase would not. They would still be obliged to get there with their own resources. Okay. And so this kind of gets to the long-term changes in the overall production of power, where we would be getting ours separate from their obligations.
Okay. Thank you.
We have one person signed up.
Angus Duncan.
As Angus is making his way up, I want to take this opportunity to thank Dean Funk and Portland General Electric, who has been instrumental in poking at and challenging and improving over the past months on this issue. So Dean, in the back row, thank you for your work and the work of your team on this issue. We really appreciate it. We're very proud to be the home and headquarters of Portland General Electric. Mr. Duncan.
Mayor Adams, commissioners, thank you. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, not to be confused with the Bonneville Power Administration. We don't have their debt, their
What's
revenue.
What's your favorite dam?
Or their nuclear obligations. We are a 501c nonprofit headquartered in Portland and also a commercial business. And I came here today, and I'm also chair of the state's Global Warming Commission. And I parenthetically, I think, want to acknowledge the really very substantial contributions that city staff have made over the last several years to the state's climate policies, transportation policies, and the greenhouse gas elements of those. It's been very important. I'm here to support the city's overall sustainability and carbon reduction strategies and policies, and specifically this proposal to continue to acquire renewable energy credits. I have a little paternal pride here that I have to acknowledge, since the Bonneville Environmental Foundation was actually the first entity nationally to put RECs out on the counter as a retail product back in the year 2000.
It's a REC.
Huh? A REC is a renewable energy credit. That's what you're buying. Sorry.
You knew that.
Had a 100% national market share that year of a very small national market. We now have something south of a 5% national market share because the RECs market nationally has grown very substantially. The foundation also works in watershed restoration, develops renewable energy projects for everything from a 200 megawatt wind project up in south central Washington, to several hundred solar school projects around the country for a variety of clients. We developed two solar projects for the city of Portland at the East Portland Community Center and the East Portland Wellfield. And I mention this, you know, not just to strut a little bit, but also to make the point that we are a small business in the city of Portland. We're a business that works in renewable energy and sustainability generally. You know, we have revenues between $6 and $10 million a year. And one of the reasons we can successfully do that is that we can trade on, we can leverage the reputation of the city of Portland nationally. And we're certainly far from alone or far from the largest business in this community that leverages that. So this expenditure is probably justifiable on business development alone, let alone the environmental leadership effects of it. I want to be mindful of your time, but I want to walk through briefly how RECs operate, because I want to make sure you understand what the effects are here. And I speak here as both a buyer and seller of RECs and as a renewable energy project developer. Where there has been criticism of RECs, sometimes it is a criticism that the RECs revenues are windfall profits to developers, that the project would have been developed with or without them, and so it's just a feel-good kind of expenditure. I can speak as a developer and as a collaborative developer with many others, both large and small projects.